You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. I'm sure that for many of you, the name Frank Lloyd Wright sticks out, one of America's most famous architects. But how about Buckminster Fuller, a name that's probably not a household name, and yet this man's architectural genius and his creative abilities have become renowned, especially among designers. And the new book, biography featuring Buckminster Fuller, is Inventor of the Future, The Life of Buckminster Fuller. And my guest this week is the author, Alex Nevala Lee. And we'll be talking with Alex for the next half hour about his book and the life and times of Buckminster Fuller. And I must tell you that even as a history buff, the name did not resonate with me. But after reading the book, many of you will be very familiar with his work and his imprint on design work around the world, actually. Alex, nice to have you with us.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
You could have written about anybody. I mean, everybody has, you know, a person or an individual, especially when it comes down to a biography, who captures their imagination, someone who interests them. But why Buckminster Fuller?
So just now you said something like, you know, Fuller is not really a household name. And, you know, one thing I want to start out by noting is that, you know, during his lifetime, he really was. So he died in 83. So I was 3 years old at the time, and so I was not old enough to really be aware of him while he was still around. But during, I would say at the peak of his career, he was incredibly famous. Mm. He was, you know, perhaps the most famous futurist in the world. He was an icon for a lot of young people, especially in colleges, in the counterculture. You know, it's strange because, you know, when he was in his 70s and 80s, you know, he was drawing audiences like packed lecture halls, you know, around the world of college kids, you know, who really responded to his message. And so, you know, chronologically speaking, I come, you know, from one generation after that. But I grew up in the Bay Area, and when I was younger, you know, Fuller was still, at least to me, a presence. He was still someone who you heard about and talked about. In large part because of a book called The Whole Earth Catalog, which I read a lot growing up. And, you know, this is a kind of an oversized guide to tools and books for the counterculture that was popular in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, Fuller is all over that catalog. You know, he was a big influence on that book. And through that that book and kind of like that community, he really became an influence on what became Silicon Valley. A lot of the founders of, you know, kind of the tech world, including people like Steve Jobs, you know, were Fuller fans, and you can really see his impact on that world even today.
Now, Alec, let me ask you, I mean, obviously architecture was a mainstay in his life, but were there other forms of design work that he's noted for?
Yes. So So Fuller is probably the best known today for geodesic structures like domes. So if you've seen Epcot Center at Disney World, you know, that entire structure is essentially an homage to Fuller and his ideas. If you've seen playground domes, you know, the kids climb on, you know, today, you know, that's basically because of Fuller. Things like dome tents, you know, so he certainly like left an impact on the world through that one structure, that one design. But this is just one project out of an incredible number of things he worked on during his lifetime. You know, as I kind of note in the book, you know, it wasn't until he was in his early 50s that he kind of broke through to the mainstream with the dome. And at that point, he had really been active as a designer and as a kind of like a public intellectual for decades. You know, he kind of started out talking about housing and trying to build a prefabricated house that could be constructed in a factory and sent anywhere in the country. And to him, this was the answer to the housing crisis. It was a way to like make sure that everyone had the right to shelter. And he's talking about this stuff in the late 20s. You know, so he's very much ahead of his time when it comes to that, you know, that problem. But, you know, he's also talking about geometry. He's talking about decentralization. He's talking about remote working, you know, all these ideas that I think have become very much kind of taken for granted these days. You know, Fuller was talking about during the Great Depression. And so, you know, I think he deserves a lot of credit for kind of foreseeing a lot of issues and challenges that, you know, we're still talking about today.
You know, I feel that today, and I want to get your sense on this, that today you and I, if we had a novel idea, I think we'd have more likelihood of getting acceptance, or at least somebody listening and looking at whatever plans it may be. But I'm thinking back early in his career, and you emphasize this very much in the book, that he was a futurist. I guess another way of putting that is somebody who had a vision, looking way, you know, much further into the future. Did he find it hard back then, especially starting out? With people thinking, wow, this guy's crazy. You know, this idea could never possibly work. Or, you know, why alter status quo? Everything's fine the way it is. Did he have to deal with any of those frustrations?
Yeah, you know, I mean, one thing about Fuller that I find kind of interesting is that he becomes a futurist almost by accident. You know, he does not set out to say, this is how the future is going to be. He says, this is how the present should be now, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to actually build these houses. I'm going to start a company that will, you know, revolutionize housing, and I can build a car, and I can build a prefab bathroom. You know, these are all projects he was trying to realize in real time himself. And he raised money for them. He tried to attract investors. He, you know, was very energetic when it came to publicizing his ideas in print and in person, and he tried for decades to really make it happen. And I would say it's you know, early on, you know, he realized that it was actually probably easier in some ways to stick a claim as a futurist, to say, oh, you know, this is something that should happen, this is something that will happen, you know, and to kind of justify his projects by saying these are part of larger social trends. You know, this is something that's going to happen no matter what, you know, I do. So things like decentralization, you know, like the urban landscape is changing. We're going to start to, you know, live further apart. We're going to start to work from home. You know, we're going to be able to like have houses that allow us to live anywhere. You know, he was able to frame these things as you know, inevitable results of technological progress. And he just happens to be the person who has the designs that will actually make them happen. But this is, in a lot of ways, a marketing strategy. You know, this is something that he does to generate interest in his ideas and to, you know, raise money and to get attention, you know, for things that he really hoped to realize himself.
I give the guy credit. I mean, many times you have the creative knack, you have the creative ability, but you know, as you just alluded to, you also need the savviness of the marketing to be able to put it forth before the you know, the buying public and hope that they that they find appeal. What about early life? I mean, I'm always interested in someone who rises above and you know, leaves a lasting legacy. About what their early life was. Sometimes you hear somebody came from, you know, a desolate background with no inspiration, nobody there to be a real influence in their life. What was his life like?
So I like to think of Fuller in some ways as the prototype of the modern startup founder, right? You look at his life and its arc and his strategies, you know, these remind me very strongly of the people who are trying to raise money for technological ideas today. And one thing that a lot of these people do have in common is that they are privileged. You know, Fuller came from a very old New England family that when he was growing up, you know, wasn't wealthy exactly, but they were well off. And, you know, he went to Harvard, he dropped out, like a lot of, or he was asked to leave. So, you know, he resembles people like Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates, you know, who had that background, right? But then went off to do their own kind of ambitious projects. And I think that's actually important to bear in mind because Fuller, you know, he liked to kind of portray himself as this visionary who came out of nowhere. But, you know, he really was part of this privileged world, and it allowed him to take risks that people who did not have those advantages probably could not, because Fuller failed at almost everything he ever tried for years. You know, like the first half of his life, it's like it's a long series of failed attempts to start businesses and to, you know, generate enthusiasm for these projects. And, you know, and he gets to do it repeatedly. And, you know, a lot of people who didn't come from that background might have had one chance to fail, and that was it. Fuller, like a lot of, you know, entrepreneurs, was lucky in that he was given the chance to fail many times before he finally succeeded.
And I'm glad you mentioned the people like the Bill Gateses of the world and the Zuckerbergs and you know, even the Bransons of the world, people who you know, you think came from well-bred backgrounds and had the best of educations, really trailblazers. And that's so often the case with many of these people who, like I said, who leave a lasting legacy. They finally, for whatever reason, get fed up and decide to, you know, charter their own course. And that's where all the inspiration and all the talent comes from. I just want to take a quick pause to remind folks that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. And if you're just joining us, welcome. If you've been with us from the outset, my guest this week is author Alec Nevala Ali, and his new book is Inventor of the Future, Life of Buckminster Fuller, a man who has his imprint. And Alec, you alluded to the Epcot. I've been there, but I didn't realize even the Montreal Expo Dome. But what was it? Let me go back to that for a minute. I mean, of all the things that somebody with an architectural mindset, people think, oh, whoa, high skyscrapers and beautiful mosaic front and entryways. Was a dome a personal passion for him?
You know, it's funny. The dome emerges almost by accident from his interest in geometry. So Fuller is like fascinated by making these models out of wire or sticks and string, because he's very hands-on. He's not really someone who understands mathematics on a deep level, at least not in sort of the conventional sense. But he has an incredible intuitive grasp of structure. Okay, and he kind of pursues this idea, especially after it becomes impossible for him to raise money to build a big house. I kind of mentioned this earlier, he had a string of failures as a businessman. And in the late 40s, it looked like he was not going to be able to raise that kind of money ever again. And so what happened is that, the dome is this incredible structure that, it has a lot of advantages in itself. It's a hemisphere, so it encloses the maximum interior space using the minimum surface area. It can be made out of all kinds of materials like cardboard or plywood, and it can be made very cheaply. So he can develop this idea. It might take millions of dollars to develop like a full working house, but for a dome, you can go to like the five and dime store or the hardware store and pick up the materials and build it over, a few weeks with some college kids. So to him, this is like his way forward. It's like an amazing thing that he can make on his own without having to raise money from outside investors. And the best part in some ways is that the dome looks futuristic. It's got this sort of triangulated scaffolding structure that people are really excited by. It photographs really well. It looks good. And so, for like almost no money at all, you can build this thing that looks like a futuristic, innovative technology, which is amazing. Like that's the big part, a big part of the reason that it takes off. It's because, it was something that he could actually execute on a very low budget that made people think that, oh, wow, this is like the architecture of the future.
And if you, I don't know if you've ever visited, but you go to Disneyland, and I was very young at the time, and I can remember seeing the Epcot, and as you talked about the dome, and I can remember my younger siblings just thinking, look at this, the biggest cupcake I've ever saw in my life. But it was something that his imprint was firmly established with. It left his mark. And he continued to do that right along. Was he? Sometimes I think that highly creative people. You hear this many. You probably more so than I. You hear this that they their ability to interact with other humans is not as not as easy or as cordial as perhaps you and I talking as we are now. They tend to be recluse. They tend to want solitude. Was he a social guy? I mean, did he have a lot of friends and influences?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was very social. I mean, this is a big part of the reason why he succeeded, because, he was a charismatic person and he had a lot of friends, and I talk about, many of his famous friends in this book, people like John Cage and Isamu Noguchi, Claire Booth Luce, Frank Lloyd Wright. These are people that he cultivated and kind of was able to use. I mean, he also, had strong friendships with many of them, but he was also very ambitious. He was someone who was networking and trying to get ahead. And this is something that, again, is like not always clear to people who learn about Fuller, as he was toward the end of his life, right? Because in his 70s, he has kind of evolved into this very grandfatherly, almost benign-seeming figure, which in itself is something of a illusion, because he remains, you know, ambitious and demanding of people, you know, to the very end. But early on, you know, in his 30s and 40s, you know, he is so driven, and he is such a, you know, he's someone who very deliberately goes after what he wants, and doesn't always succeed, and often, you know, gets, you know, sidetracked or goes, you know, down these weird dead ends. But, you know, he's always, like, very motivated to succeed. And I think this is hard to see when you encounter him for the first time when he's an old man, because, you know, the old man you see in the 70s is the product of an incredibly ambitious young man who was active, you know, in the late 20s and onward.
You talked about, you know, and this is true of anybody, even the most successful people in the world, there's an awful lot of sacrifice, but there's also a lot of disappointment, especially early on. Were there projects that he felt that he was very passionate about first and foremost, and more importantly, felt that, you know, it's a no-brainer. This is something that should have caught on and never really got off the launch pad, as they say. Was there any one particular design or idea that he felt very passionate about that never really gained momentum?
Yeah, I mean, there are many of them, actually. The one that kind of comes to mind is the idea that I mentioned earlier of a dwelling industry. It's the idea that you would have, like, a design for a house that could be built in a factory and just shipped anywhere in the world. And, you know, to make this happen, it would have to be very light. And so he develops designs for houses that use materials like aluminum, and they use tension structures like wires, you know, to make them lighter than conventional houses would be. Just because, you know, otherwise they would overwhelm, like, the trucking system. You needed, like, things that were light and portable, you know. And he had this idea in the late 20s, and he pursued it until he died. And he pursued it for 60 years, you know, almost 60 years. And, you know, the dome came very close to that ideal, you know, and in some ways that was the closest he ever got to that goal. But, you know, he really wanted to change the way people lived. He wanted to change the way people thought about housing, you know, so that housing wasn't just this, like, physical thing that you lived in, but it was a service. It was something that you use like a telephone, you know, because when we think about buying a new phone, you know, it's not a big deal for us to say, okay, well, I'll get a new phone, but, like, the service of providing me access to information is unchanged. You know, that's the important thing. Yeah. And that's kind of how he wanted people to see their houses. He wanted them to exchange houses as casually as they would, you know, change phones. And, you know, he never quite got to that point, even after decades of trying.
I can't help but think that in this current economic environment with, you know yourself, there isn't a part of the country where real estate isn't going through the roof, that today this thing would have flown, especially if he could have done it in an economic way of people being able to afford that first house. It might have been a Buckminster Fuller house, and that would have certainly been, solved a major problem. And I think many people would have jumped right on the bandwagon. But as they say, timing is everything. So it sounds like, you know, at the end of his life, if he looked back upon it, that he felt satisfied, he felt fulfilled, that for the most part, no, not everything took off, not everything went exactly the way he wanted, but by and large, he did indeed, as I said earlier, left a lasting legacy. So did he go out feeling satisfied that he really contributed to society and also to the industry that he felt so passionate about, that he left something that'll be long lasting?
I would say that he had probably mixed feelings about his legacy. I think he had no reason to complain about the level of attention and acclaim he received. You know, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom just before he died. He was covered, you know, in Time magazine, and, you know, was basically the center of a cult, you know, shall we say, you know, among young people, you know, toward the end. So, you know, he certainly had reason to be pleased by that. I think he felt that despite his fame and despite, you know, some level of influence, he had not achieved the goals he wanted. You know, I think that he looked around at the way the world was in the early 80s, and he was very aware of the ways in which it fell short of his kind of utopian idea of what could have been. So, you know, I think when he died, he hoped that, you know, other people would carry forward his ideas and these goals, which, you know, as you noted, in some ways did not happen. And I think a big part of that reason is that it was so much about Fuller himself. You know, he was the center of this movement he created. It was all driven by his energy and his personality. And after he died, you know, he did not really leave a like a system in place to perpetuate those goals after he was gone?
You know, in the clothing industry, maybe not so much today, but and you're probably familiar, the names like Pierre Cardin were long lasting, even after the man had passed on. The Halstons of the world, the Andy Warhols of the world, even today, those names, I think for the most part, resonate with most people. So outside of the design world, you know, like I said, I plead innocence. I mean, I did not hear of or was not aware that Buckminster Fuller was really a very important person in the design world. So, you know, will his legacy or can it be pushed further than whatever it is now? I mean, as you talked about designers. Even young designers going through school, coming out of school, will probably have heard that name, picked up your book, or used him as inspiration. But what about down the road? Will he have that lasting influence on people and design?
I really hope so. I mean, I didn't, you know, even have a chance to talk about his ideas, you know, in terms of geometry and other things. But, you know, they are incredibly powerful concepts. And I think, you know, he discovers rules that are actually very useful in terms of understanding nature and looking how nature builds, you know, in ways that I think are undeniable. I do think that he has suffered a bit from being idealized after his death. I think a lot of the books about him that have been published so far tend to present a very uncritical picture of him. And I think we as a society have evolved to the point where we know that people like this, people like Steve Jobs, people like Elon Musk, you know, there's a downside, right? There are consequences to becoming this kind of person. And I think if we kind of present the consequences and the full picture, you know, Fuller will kind of assume his proper position as an incredibly important figure in design and technology. And I'm really hoping that this biography does that.
What is the, I mean, every artist, every person, I mean, if you sit down one-on-one, eventually somebody says, I want to be remembered for this. I want to be remembered for that. In terms of the history of his work, what is probably today his greatest accomplishment, or what design, what work of design still stands out among all the other things that he did? That really were the masterpiece and the, you know, the golden ring, if you will, of all the work he was involved in.
So Fuller, you know, saw himself as someone who was describing how the universe works, right? You know, he had this very mystical sense of the geometry and like these structural principles he was discussing, you know, that this is an accurate description of, you know, sort of reality. And, you know, I think he overstated the merits of, you know, that system in some ways. But you look at things like, you know, virus structure and the interior of the cell, and especially, you know, the carbon molecule called Buckminster Fullerene, right? This is a carbon molecule that was discovered in the mid-80s that has the structure of a geodesic sphere. And the scientists who discovered it, you know, they actually were inspired by Fuller. You know, they knew about Fuller's work, and they, you know, drew on his designs to kind of figure out, you know, what would this molecule look like. And that, to me, is a huge legacy. You know, I think Fuller would be pleased by this fact. Like, to him, it was less about any particular artifact or particular invention as these principles. And I think that, you know, when you look at his influence on the sciences, especially, you see that a lot of those principles ended up being very useful in a practical sense. And I think there are discoveries, you know, that have yet to be made that will draw upon his way of thinking, you know, in ways that I think will be really productive. So I think if he were still around, he would say that's what he would like his legacy to be, like these axioms and principles of geometry that might provide inspiration for future scientists.
Well, and that's interesting, because no one, I don't think, on the surface would think that, oh, well, you know, the guy did a lot of architectural work. What does that got to do with inspiring people in the, as you said, in maybe in the health community? But you never realize that design doesn't mean that it's strictly meant for strictly buildings or building houses or structures. Sometimes design work, the basics of unique design, really can be used in so many different ways. So kudos to him in that regard. And yeah, I think I'd have to agree with you that perhaps if he were here today and said, Jesus, some of my designs were inspiration you know, in the scientific world that could actually help, you know, extend lives or help people, you know, who suffer from medical maladies, whatever it may be. Again, going back to, I know that you said the dome was really something that, you know, he's noted for. If we were to put a collection together of structures that people would be familiar with, which one for you at least stands out as the, you know, the reigning king of design in terms of Buckminster Fuller? Is it the Epcot Dome, or was there one structure in particular that really caught your attention?
Well, you know, Fuller was not always directly involved with a lot of the structures that, you know, he is credited with designing. So like the Montreal Biosphere, which I think you mentioned earlier, you know, is incredibly beautiful, you know, a three-quarter dome that I think is just one of the most beautiful buildings in the world. Fuller, you know, he was publicly accredited as the architect. He did not actually do much of anything. You know, he did not want a dome. He wanted something else entirely. And they went with the dome, and they went with, like, various structural things against his wishes. So I always like try to note that. That said, you know, that's a beautiful building. And Epcot Center is to me, you know, so iconic and interesting because Disney, you know, Disney did not involve Fuller. Disney did not even ask him for his permission. They went ahead and designed this beautiful sphere, and they called it Spaceship Earth, right, which is one of Fuller's, you know, like defining metaphors without even asking him, you know. And I find that's so fascinating because Fuller, you know, is someone who spent his entire career trying to maintain control over these ideas. But by the mid-70s, they had kind of passed into the culture, right? They had been absorbed by the larger world so that Disney treated them as though they were in the public domain. So to me, Epcot Center is the biggest monument to Fuller in large part because he was not involved and he didn't even know about it until, you know, the design was almost finished. But, you know, it just testifies to his impact and his importance.
Yeah, that's incredible because I always thought of, I've read biographies on Walt Disney himself, and he always, you know, a driven man, no question about it, very focused on what he was doing. But I always thought that he, you know, he had a high regard for those equally talented, even if they weren't necessarily cartoonists or people making movies. But, yeah, it's funny you said that. At the end of his life, Alec, was he a wealthy man? I mean, did he reap any windfalls, at least monetarily, from all the work he did?
The answer is no. All right. And I think this is actually fascinating because, you know, there were periods when Fuller did make money. Okay, he made a lot of money from what's called the Radome, which is a radar enclosure that was used, you know, up north to protect antennas that were there to, like, you know, detect signs of a Soviet air attack. And so, like, for about 10 years, maybe, he earned a lot of money from those designs, from the government. And he spent all of it, you know, and later on, the you know, he no longer earned a lot of money from the dome patents that he owned. And so he would mostly make a living by lecturing. He would just go around the world talking to people and charging fees for these talks. But again, it all got spent, and it got spent mostly on research. You know, he had his own little operation in place that employed assistants and designers and engineers in, like, a little office in Philadelphia. And, you know, he spent all that money on research because, you know, he thought that, you know, this big breakthrough was always just around the corner, you know. But in practice, it just meant that, you know, he died without a lot of assets. I mean, he certainly had property. You know, there are things that the family still owns. But, you know, he did not become as rich as you would expect, like given how famous and how, you know, ubiquitous, like, those designs were. But that was. I would say it was a choice, but he had no alternative in his mind. He had to spend that money, you know, in order to further his project.
Right, right. And you know, kudos to the guy. I mean, you know, like you said, he could have pocketed the profits, walked away, and, you know, maybe lived his life on a beautiful tropic island. But he was never satisfied, and that's always I always think that's the hallmark of greatness, especially in innovation. You keep pushing, until you hopefully find that you know, the thing that works well, or the thing that will make a big impact on more and more people's lives. Obviously, as I said at the outset, you know, Buckminster Fuller may not have been a household name, but certainly Alec's new book, Inventor of the Future, you know, pick that up. It'll certainly, even if you're not an architectural expert, and you don't have to be. This is really about a man's life, and the innate talents that this man had, and the imprint that he left, not only here in this country, but certainly across the globe. And Alex, real quick, if people want to reach out to you directly, post some questions, find out something about your background and your work, how might they do that?
So my name is Alec Neville Ali, which is pretty distinctive. So if you can spell it correctly, you can look me up on Google. And my blog is like not very active, but that's the best way to contact me directly. And I'm on Twitter. And I love hearing from people. You know, I've already heard from people after this book came out last week with all kinds of interesting, you know, observations and information. And so I welcome any and all feedback that people want to give.
Yeah. And as I said, the book is now out in full distribution. Inventor of the Future, The Life of Buckminster Fuller. And as Alex has put out that invitation, any questions you want to just pose questions to him, find out more about his work, that's certainly available as well. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.